If it's nerdy, we're into it.
Gaming, movies, television, wrestling, comics, whatever. We are Kyle Eckert and Chris Heck, two lifelong friends with a passion for the world of geekery.
And this is the Geek Ketchup Podcast.
Scramble your R-Wings, Geek Ketchup family, because today we're headed to the Lylat system for our retro game spotlight on the Super Nintendo classic Star Fox. I'm Kyle Eckert.
And I'm Chris Heck.
And this is Season 2, Chapter 24. In February of 1993, Nintendo and Argonaut Games gave gamers around the world something they'd never experienced before, an accelerated 3D gaming experience on their home consoles. Straight from the mind of Shigeru Miyamoto, famed creator of the countless other IPs like Mario and Zelda, we were introduced to Team Star Fox, an elite team of pilots including Slippy Toad, Peppy Hare, Falco Lombardi, and Fox McCloud. Taking control of team leader McCloud, this spaceship rail shooter placed us in the cockpit, or just behind it depending on your camera preferences, of an R-Wing fighter battling to defeat Fox's archenemy Andross as he threatens to overthrow the Lylat system. Star Fox was unique. In a time when 2D games dominated the market, Nintendo went outside the box and introduced the Super FX chip, which allowed them to simulate 3D graphics. This change gave players much more freedom of movement. It also brought in new gameplay mechanics and graphical possibilities for game designers. Star Fox utilized both, with its 3D polygon graphics and flight controls as you battled both in space and on various planet surfaces. The game guided you through levels by having you fly through gates and boost rings, picking up items and upgrades along the way as you took down a wide variety of enemies. Upon release, the series became an instant success, earning the award for Best Shooter of 1993 by Electronic Gaming Monthly and selling over 4 million copies in the next 5 years. The original Star Fox was followed up with multiple sequels and reboots, as well as a plethora of Fox McCloud cameo appearances in other titles, including Super Smash Bros., Stunt Race FX, and Tekken Tag Tournament 2. Chris, you've been a huge fighter jet and pilot fan as far back as I can remember, and we're definitely going to get into the history of this franchise and this game, but let's start with your history with Star Fox.
Yeah, I remember as a kid, I got a love of all things fighter jets and planes from one of my grandfathers who was in the Air Force and would always take me to, you know, the air shows at the local airport. We live there in the greater DC area, so lots of airports, lots of air shows. And then when I merged that in with gaming and we started seeing, you know, some of the original vertical scrolling shooters, you know, anything that was plane related, I was into when it came to video games. So moving over to my other grandfather that I talk about all the time, who was the big gamer, who had all the Nintendo stuff, you know, he had Star Fox right when it came out, and I was just captivated. And honestly, it's one of the few games where he owned it that I remember I also had a copy of it because I liked it that much. You know, a lot of times we kind of used him as a personal blockbuster because he had so many video games and we could just borrow them and sign them out. He had this little sheet that we had to sign them out.
Oh,
and
man, a full-on sheet. Watch out.
Yeah, that kind of came a little later as my younger sisters and cousins all started doing the same thing. You know, I was the oldest, so of course I got a little more freedom up front, but then it turned into the sign-out sheet so he could track them. But anyways.
Yeah, I'm thinking you could check out five games. They were limited to three.
Right. I had the premium club pass. But, you know, it was just one of those things where the planes and being into that new 3D look and feel, it was just kind of mind-blowing at the time. It was it was the most advanced plane game I had ever played at that point, you know, in 1993, introducing 3D graphics that we had never seen. And so this game has just always stood out as one of those games that I absolutely remember that I owned, you know, as a kid and played a ton of.
Yeah.
Like, absolutely played a ton of this game. And I always remember that it just kicked my ass. You know, like, it wasn't easy as a kid, especially as you get closer to Venom in the later levels, or if you try the higher difficulty paths. Like, it's not an easy game at times. So
No.
But, you know, would play a ton on my own. We played it together with a group of friends. I remember going to my grandfather's house, and we would play it over there and take turns. But, you know, he had it on SNES, and then, of course, Star Fox 64. So we would kind of go back and forth on both of those. And so I was really happy when we decided to take a look at this because it had been a while since I had played it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's definitely a classic. I mean, we're both children. I'm going to actually give out our birth year. We're both children of 1986, which the famed Top Gun came out in 1986.
There you go.
So that is reason. And we did live in the greater DC area. So the Blue Angels and the Thunderbirds were pretty much at every air show that we were going to as kids. So, you know, that instantly gets ingrained in you. And who doesn't want to be a Top Gun pilot? You know, you look cool, you wear the glasses, and you get to, like, dogfight. That just sounds awesome.
Yeah. Well, I'll take it one step further since you brought up Top Gun in a movie. Because in my notes for when we break down the game and we start talking about story, just to give a little preview here, I actually think that this game was pretty much copied from Iron Eagle. And I was totally cool with it because, like, I was a bigger Iron Eagle fan and with Chappie and all of that than I was of Top Gun. Loved them both, but Iron Eagle was always I liked the F-16. I was just an F-16 guy, you know.
That's just my preferred, you know, my preferred fighter jet.
Preferred fighter jet. But, you know, if you look at the story, the way Fox becomes a pilot because his dad was essentially a pilot and shot down. Like, that is literally the story of Iron Eagle, where the kid, I think Doug Masters, I got to remember his exact name, it's been a while, but his dad, F-16 pilot with Chappie, gets shot down overseas, and then he's got to go and rescue him and become a pilot himself, you know? So, anyways, I just had to throw that in there since you broke the wall and threw out Top Gun. But either way, I mean, it just sucked you in. If you were a kid back then and you saw Star Fox, you were into it.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I don't want to tangent on fighter jet movies, but Top Gun also has that exact same plot where his dad was a fighter pilot and died.
Ah, that is true.
It's all the same.
Okay.
Yeah, it happens in the conversation at the, you know, when they have the barbecue with Viper. Like, yeah.
That is true.
It's a
smaller
like
detail
Gun,
in so. Top Gun than it is in Iron Eagle. Because it's like the central plot in Iron Eagle.
Oh, yeah.
Good call.
It's just
Good
a throwaway. Call. It's a throwaway thing in Top Gun. Like, and we'll save those conversations for another day because I could talk about Top Gun all day. But getting back to Star Fox, I own Star Fox. But I've stated this on a few occasions that my house was mainly focused around sports games.
Right.
So while we had Star Fox, like, we definitely owned it. It's like, you know, for every four video games that my brother got to decide what we would buy, I got like the fifth. So, like, that was my decision. We bought like Madden 95 or, you know, NHL this or Tecmo Super Bowl that. And then it's like, okay, well, Jeremy, you've gotten to pick four games. Kyle gets to pick now. And I was like, Star Fox. Let's buy Star Fox.
Yeah.
So we owned it, but I didn't really get to play it a lot.
Gotcha.
And it's always been a part of my collection, and I've always enjoyed playing it when I could. But I was starting to remember, and we'll get into it as we replayed it, I'm not sure I ever actually beat it as a kid.
Yeah, I don't think I could say so either. There was definitely some moments in this one that I didn't quite remember, so I think I'm with you there. Like, it was a tough game. I mean, it's still a tough game, really.
Yeah.
But back then, you know, not being as experienced gamers, you know, not maybe being as dedicated the way we are now, or you don't play the games the same when you're a kid as you do as an adult. You know, all of the above, right? But I had that same thought.
Yeah, and it just, you know, I couldn't remember beating it, and then, but I do remember liking it so much. Yeah. And also, I think part of that for me is just Fox. Fox McCloud. He's so iconic. Foxes are kind of my jam as far as animals. I've said on multiple occasions, probably off mic, that Fox is my spirit animal, and I just connect with them. So I think it's more about Fox McCloud, and especially getting into the Super Smash Bros. Era, I like to be Fox McCloud. So it might have been my memories and my fascination with Star Fox are not so much with the game Star Fox, but more with Fox McCloud and himself. And then even further, I didn't have a 64, so I'd never given a chance to play Star Fox 64.
Sure.
And then very recently, I started to explore the 3DS game, Star Fox Command, which was on the 3DS. And I, like, at, you know, in preparation of us talking about Star Fox, I was like, oh, I'm going to go out and play as many of the Star Fox titles as I can. And through various ways, you find ways to play them. And I got to play the 3DS one, and that one was pretty cool because it brought a little bit more lore into the Star Fox, like, universe, where it developed personalities a little more, side characters that we got to see in the later kind of in the later series, they started to expand the team out beyond the core four there.
Right.
But so ultimately, yeah, like Star Fox, I love it and have this fascination with it. But when I really think back on it as a kid, I'm like, did I really get to play it all that much? Like, I don't know.
Yeah, one console and being the younger brother doesn't end up turning into a good recipe for you getting to really get in some good sessions on what you want to play.
Right, and it's a one-player game, so true. I'm just playing co-pilot as I did with all one-player games. I sit there and I hold the second controller and pretend.
As did many younger siblings around the country. Now, I think it's really interesting with Star Fox that it was such a popular IP that has really stood around, you know, with Nintendo, and nobody thinks that it's a lackluster IP. Nobody talks shit about Fox McCloud. You know what I mean? Like, he is right up there. Maybe he's not as big of a Nintendo icon as a Mario or a Samus, but he is right up there. And the fact that he has had such longevity, even though they've made so few games.
Yeah.
Like, compared to the Marios or Metroids or Zeldas, but yet he's still so beloved. And, you know, people love when he shows up in Smash Brothers or some of these other IPs. So I do hope we get a new Star Fox at some point, right, on the Switch or beyond, because it has been a really long time. But he's just got an interesting history, and we wanted to touch on a few things here, because I know one of the inspirations for us to take a look and do a spotlight here on Star Fox was the High Score documentary that came out on Netflix a couple of months back, because one of the episodes of that really dived into how Star Fox came to be.
Yeah.
And the story of what Nintendo was doing at the time, creating this new game to go along with what was going to be the new Super Nintendo console, and then what was going on in England with a guy named Dylan Cuthbert, who was essentially an 18-year-old hacker, you know, trying to figure out how to put 3D games on a Game Boy. And, you know, when they merged, when Nintendo found out what he was doing, instead of being kind of the Nintendo that we know today that, you know, just shuts everything down and sues you into submission, they actually reached out to him and brought them to Japan and wanted to know what they had figured out. And they worked together essentially to create Star Fox and bring the 3D graphics to a console gaming system, which had never been done before.
Yeah, yeah. And when Dylan and he worked at Argonaut Games, and they had developed this, and they basically took apart a Game Boy and hacked it, which was one of the coolest parts of that documentary, how many times we saw that's how games got developed, is they took the core console and then took it apart and then modded it, or took a core cabinet and modded it. And they go to Japan, and he fully expected to be sued and ended up showing them what he had done. And they were so thrilled that they then in turn said, well, how about you come work for us and develop a new game?
Yeah.
So like that, as an 18-year-old kid, that's got to blow your mind. Like, just getting into the industry, all you want to do is make games and have fun. And here's the biggest video gaming company on the planet saying, this looks awesome. Thank you for hacking our stuff. Let's set you up with a contract and you can make our next like premier title. Because then then they put Miyamoto on it, and like I said, Mario, Zelda, Donkey Kong, the list goes on and on for the number of games that guy has created and developed. So you knew that you were in for something big.
Yeah, it was really, really cool to see that, and I love seeing some of the details. And really, like with some of the older games, one thing you really, really come to realize when they dig into how some of those, you know, iconic early industry games, you know, came to be, they were made on threads.
Yeah.
I mean, like, there are so many just razor-thin threads that connected these people and let them get away with what they did or accomplish what they did that could have easily gone a different direction, and then we wouldn't have had, you know, Star Fox or Doom or whatever it may be.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And so I thought that that was super cool, but even just seeing the look into the challenges they had with making Star Fox, you know, they talked about how they had a few things they had to overcome. Like for 3D graphics, the SNES was not hardwired for 3D.
Yeah.
And they were pretty much too far down the line. That ship had sailed, so they had to figure out how to create 3D in another way. And that's what led to the creation of the Super FX chip, which was a microchip that they figured out they could add to the cartridge that would boost everything and utilize the hardware of the SNES in order to take it to that next level. And you think about what that did for Nintendo and a lot of the games that followed was really revolutionary.
Oh, yeah. Like, and that's, like, I think the craziest thing about the whole idea is that Star Fox ended up being, like, such a key player in 3D gaming, which is everything. Everything that comes out now is built that way. Like, it's very rare for us to get a 2D game. Typically, it's like an indie title of some kind. And, you know, like Super Meat Boy or something, Broforce, something specific that, you know, is scratching that itch or, like, trying to play to a certain crowd. But Star Fox is the origins of all of this 3D gaming. So, like, your Call of Duties and Demon's Souls, Valhalla, all these modern games with, like, this insane graphic level, you know, in putting someone in first person started with Star Fox and the Super FX chip that they were putting, like, and the mod on the cartridge is, like, mind-blowing, something you clearly can't do today.
Right. And it's super cool to look back because, I mean, we were kids. We didn't care about any of this
stuff. Yeah, we didn't know.
We didn't understand. You just knew that you threw this plastic cartridge into a plastic system that was plugged into the TV, and then you had awesomeness. And so, like, I am a huge geek for these types of documentaries to really break down the walls of the things that we have spent so much of our lives idolizing and playing and spending time with. And so I just ate up the documentary. I thought one of the other cool things that was shared in this was how the designer Miyamoto really used his life and his travels to design the game. And so when they were putting it together, it was originally a first person kind of Star Wars, old Star Wars game like shooter where you had a 3D environment, but the only thing you saw was the crosshairs essentially.
Yeah, the little reticle. Yeah.
Yeah. And so one of, they had to kind of develop through that and figure out how to, you know, create a more 3D environment. So you got the third person perspective. They talked about how they had challenges with the camera and they had to eventually separate the camera from the ship. So that way it would help you get more immersive and get a better feel of everything. But they talked about how the gates that, you know, is always so what stands out in your mind with Star Fox is you're flying through and there's all those little gates, you know, like croquet that you're flying through and you kind of follow them along as it leads you through the map. And that was all inspired by Miyamoto going to a shrine in Japan that was built, I guess, around foxes.
Yeah, and had
a lot of fox themes, right? And they were these red wooden gates that lined the pathways. And I wish I would have looked up the shrine name. I didn't. But it's really beautiful to see, you know, the way they designed it all. But that's what they took from real life. And he used that to inspire how you play the game. And then ultimately the fox inspired Fox McCloud.
Yeah, oh yeah. So you need to play more Ghost of Tsushima because they're everywhere. The Inari shrines are all over Ghost of Tsushima. So yeah, the Fushima Inari shines. And it's a fox, like a fox holding a key. And people typically would make this walk. It's like a spiritual journey for them. And I think in the documentary, they had pointed out that they were essentially working on the game and it had that Star Wars shape, but it didn't really have any character to it. It didn't have that signature Nintendo feel where it has like a mascot to it, like a character that you can be drawn to. And so they took like a Christmas break and said, like, I'm going to work on this. Like Miyamoto said, I'm going to work on this during Christmas break. And when they all came back, he had done this. He had gone on this walk and been inspired by like the walking through the tunnels to the way to this shrine and the gates and everything. It's like, this is a perfect way to take this 3D environment, this like open world flight simulator, and guide someone through it and giving them a purpose in a single direction. Because if not, I think they was worried that it was just going to get lost in the shuffle. Like the world wasn't ready the gaming world wasn't ready for the open world experience and still needed to be guided.
Right.
And it really is. It's incredibly inspirational that, you know, he went and he takes these various things that he sees throughout his life and then combines them, and then we get Star Fox out of it.
It's just like the truest, you know, definition of art.
Yeah.
And a lot of people don't think about that with video games, but, yeah, you know, looking back on some of these older games, the simpler games, a lot of those creators, you know, talking to them, seeing them in these documentaries, they point out these very basic things that we all see in life all the time, or experiences that they just had being out living their lives, and then they brought them back and injected them into these games that just resonated with people.
Yeah.
You know, and maybe that's a big reason why, is because, you know, other people have similar experiences or kind of make some of those connections. I don't know, but it's just really cool to look at history like that. And so we wanted to share some of that with this because I think Star Fox holds a more important place in the gaming lore, the gaming industry's history,
yeah,
than most people give it credit for.
Absolutely. I would agree. And we kind of kicked this whole thing off by saying how iconic Fox McCloud was. And then going into this, well, it's interesting because you're right. They've only made 9 games, 9 official Star Fox games. And most of those are reboots. Like Star Fox 64 is technically a reboot of Star Fox. Like it's the same story.
Yeah. Yeah.
But yet all of that, so only 9 entries in the series, which is nothing compared to the Zeldas and the Marios of the world. But yet a few places have done some rankings, and Fox McCloud is consistently ranked in the top 10 of the most iconic Nintendo video game characters. He's typically only beaten out by Mario, Link, and Samus.
Wow, that's amazing.
You know, and like Nintendo Power had him ranked as the 18th favorite hero of all time. Entertainment Weekly had him as the 12th coolest character.
Wow.
And actually, it's funny, we were talking about Top Gun. They basically said that he was a combination of the heroism of Luke Skywalker, the bravado of Top Gun's Maverick, and the well, a fox, like essentially. And so, yeah, I think it really speaks to exactly what you're saying. Like they've taken all these real life experiences that the everyday person goes through and taken inspiration, put it into a video game. And while there may only be 9 entries and we're not getting a lot of Star Fox, a lot of people still resonate with the character and the game.
For sure. Well, Star Fox, as we said, is a beloved game with a very interesting backstory that helped revolutionize console gaming with its jump into 3D design. Next up, we're going to break down and rate the classic. But first, let's find out who the Geek Ketchup community thought was Batman's greatest boy wonder sidekick.
Our latest Geek Ketchup community poll threw down a question that is near and dear to my heart. We asked, who is the greatest Robin of all time? Batman has had many sidekicks over the years, and several different heroes have donned the old green and red. So we're cutting out the alternate universes and limited runs, and we're narrowing the field down to the core 4. Dick Grayson, the original Robin, Jason Todd, who was second to put on the mask, the Robin of the 90s, Tim Drake, and finally the current Robin and Batman's bloodborn son, Damian Wayne. Each Robin is unique in their own way, from skill set to personality, and each should be celebrated for that, as Twitter contributor Jonathan highlighted. We couldn't agree more, Jonathan, but in some cases you still want to know who's the best. Damian would certainly advocate for naming he is the best. In the end, every Robin received at least one vote, but it was Tim Drake that got the most, the clever teenager who solved the mystery of Batman's secret identity all on his own, carving his name into the Bat family forever.
I have to say, Kyle, I thought picking the greatest Robin ever was a really tough thing to do. But if I really had to choose one, I'd go with Chris O'Donnell.
It's got a just the bat suit with nipples. I really don't even know. Oh, man.
All right. Well, before Kyle jumps through the computer and punches me in the mouth, let's jump into our breakdown and ratings here for Star Fox.
I don't even know you anymore. This is awful.
I totally digressed our conversation here. Just had to have a little fun with it. I knew that was going to get you.
Yeah, that's well done. Well done. You know what? He was in Batman Forever, too. So maybe I should draw on that appearance and not the Batman and Robin.
There you go. There you go. Forever was much better. Anyways, we're here to talk Star Fox, so it's an important point here as we get into our breakdown and our ratings to point out that we are focusing on the original Star Fox for SNES, not Star Fox 64, not Star Fox 2, not some of the others that Kyle was just mentioning. We really wanted to focus in on the original, what really gave birth to the Star Fox IP, and so we are going to be breaking down like we do with all of our Geek Ketchup reviews. So we'll be looking at the five categories of story, graphics and sounds, gameplay, technical performance, and then our personal favorite, sauciness.
Also known as the Chris O'Donnell factor.
Chris O'Donnell is very saucy. So each of us will then rate our categories at either a 0, a half, or a 1 star, with a total overall rating being somewhere between 0 and 5 stars. So let's dive into it here, Kyle, starting off with your thoughts on the story that was presented to us in this game.
So we're starting off a little rough on my end, and I do promise it will get better. But for story, I actually had to give it a 0.
Really?
Yeah, because it has no story. The story in this game is so paper thin. And I had to look up the instruction manual to confirm that there was at least some sort of backstory in the instruction manual. And there is. You get a 1-page backstory on the history of the universe and the history of the team. And you get another 1-page that has like a short 3-4 sentence blurb on each individual pilot. But as far as in-game story, there's not much there. It is kind of just boot up, like at least my, you know, how I'm seeing it, you boot up and yeah, you know, General Pepper gives you the quick breakdown of what's happening and then you get right in and you get right into the first mission, but you're never really, it never explains why, like, why do we dislike Andross and why right. is he taking over the galaxy? Sure, read the instruction manual, you'll get that backstory. But as far as in-game story, we didn't get anything. Did not even a cutscene or anything from the development team as far as telling me who these characters are.
That's totally fair. And I definitely acknowledge that it is a generic save the world type story. You know, good soldier versus bad guy. But we were just talking about how much we love Iron Eagle and Top Gun, and they're pretty much the same story. So how do you give it a 0 when you love Top Gun so much, Kyle?
Well, Top Gun at least gave me that story. Star Fox didn't give me that story. You know what I mean? Like that, and True. That's what I'm saying. Like, that's why I have to give it a 0.
You had to seek it out.
Like, yeah, I had to seek out the story. And obviously, if I had bought the game when I was 8 or 9, like, I would have the instruction manual. But am I really going to read the instruction manual for the backstory at 9 years old? Like, I understand that some 9-year-olds probably have done that and do that. But I can tell you right now, I was not one of those 9-year-olds. Like, I can't even say I looked up the buttons. I'm like, nope, I'm just going to get into the game. I'm going to figure it out.
Right.
It's just, it's one of those things. And I've done this before. And this game came out in 1993. And so I'm going to put it up to some of the other games that have come out in 1993. We were 2 years into the Super Nintendo. And in 1993, we got Secret of Mana. We got Disney's Aladdin. We got Illusion of Gaia. We got Battletoads and Double Dragon. Some of those might have the thickest of stories, but we also had Mega Man X, which had a good story.
Sure.
And Zombies Ate My Neighbors, which the story is kind of there in the title.
Sure.
So, like, once again, I think I said this before when we were talking about Ghosts and Goblins. It's, you can have games out there that tell you a story of some kind, even if it's a single panel or a single screen, and you give me something to work off of. And Star Fox just didn't do that for me. It was just kind of like General Pepper coming in and being like, we need you to fly out there and protect the universe. Blah, 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 blah. And the next thing you know, you're working from path to path and so on. So I know it's harsh, but I was like, if there's anywhere this game can be knocked, I think story is the biggest place that it takes that knock.
No, that's totally fair, and I have to apologize because I totally put you on the defensive there, but I actually generally agree with you.
Yeah.
I did give it a half star here, but my notes here are pretty much in line with what you're saying. As I said, very generic. For me, I actually kind of like the fact that it launches you right into the action despite the limited story. And I think that kind of saves it a little bit, just because, you know, even though you don't really know why you're doing what you're doing, there's, you know, flashing lights, sirens going off, and you immediately see that R-Wing and you are ready to go. So you just know you need to rise to the occasion and save the planet, save Corneria. So for me, that helped earn the half star. You know, you've got some iconic characters there. The team's fun. It's definitely a little bit more childish looking back on it now, but at the time, you know, I remember just being all about Falco and Fox and Pepe and all them, you know. So I can't go too far with it because the story is pretty much the lowest, you know, thing to look at for this game. It's really more about gameplay.
Yeah.
But I did give it the half star just because I liked a few of those aspects. And as I said, the Iron Eagle thing, you know, that really resonated with me. And I think it always will. So that was where it earned it for me.
Yeah, and you can't argue. I can't argue with some of that. You're right. Like, when you press start and you get that original, that sound out the gate, it's like, scramble the jets. And it says, scramble, scramble, scramble. Like, that gets you hyped. So, like, I will 100% agree with you there. That gets you hyped and gets you ready. But looking at it from, like, just straight up, is it actually telling me a story? Or even when you beat the game, do you get any sort of finality to the game or to the story? No, not really. It gives you your high score and you move on. And I think, you know, I don't want to sit here and just beat a dead horse, but I also think it should be noted that the developer, that Dylan, who was working on the game, said that when they had originally mocked up what the characters were going to look like, he's like, this doesn't make any sense. Why would a fox, a falcon, a toad, and a rabbit be flying, you know, airplanes in space? Why would they be doing that? What is this?
Right.
And then naturally the game started to take shape and they started to buy into the characters and the backstory and the lore, which is cool. But as far as what you actually gave me in the game, I'm just not seeing it.
Yeah. Well, there was actually a moment where he did, because he did talk about that, but he did come back full circle and he clarified that Miyamoto, who pretty much made him understand though, that you have to make things fun. You have to make them kind of zany, you know, and Nintendo just was tapped into what kids like,
yeah.
You know? And so, I mean, if you're an 18, 19 year old, you're definitely going to think that Peppy hair is just the lamest thing you've ever seen. But at the same time, I think Nintendo was just dialed in at that point and they knew, hey, if we put these things into these games, kids are going to just go berserk for them. And that's kind of what happened.
Oh yeah. And I compare it a lot in this case. It's like, you need the Jobs and the Wozniak.
Yeah.
you need the creativity and you need, you know, the solid tech base. And that's really what it was. He was 17, 18 years old. All he cared about was coding and designing, and he did an excellent job at that. But you also needed that other side of the house to make the user experience more fun.
Right. Yeah, for sure. Well, since you mentioned kind of coding and designing, I think that takes us perfectly into our next category here, which was graphics and sounds. So what were your thoughts on those aspects of the game?
So graphics and sound gets the full 1 point. I give it the full 1 point. I give it the full one star. I think, you know, the graphics for the time, for 1993, 3D polygon graphics, like, it's nothing I had ever seen before. And still kind of like looks good, and even replaying it to this day, I actually thought it still had a pretty solid look to it. And then sound wise is typically what gets me in our rating system, is like, that is a big deal to me. And it has an awesome theme. Like, the main title theme is incredible. And I don't care if you know it from Star Fox video game or from the Super Smash Bros. Level, that theme is legit and you can kind of jam to it. And the sound effects are on point as well, from the boost that the R-Wing does when you shoot forward, the pew-pew-pew sound of your lasers, the voice, the, like, double blasters. That's awesome. And then maybe it's giving it a little bit of character here, but each individual character, whether it was Falco or Peppy or Slippy Toad or Fox himself all had like a unique little voice, even if it wasn't a real word and it was just kind of like Peanuts teacher mumbling. It was still that, you know, you know what I mean? Like it, you knew who was talking, even if it was nonsense. So it got the full 1 point for me. And I know I just kind of like ran through the whole gamut there. So I didn't want to take away all the stuff that you had to talk about. But where did this one fall for you?
Fairly in line with you. I might have been a little bit tougher on it just because I was looking at some of the individual moments I experienced as I went through it. I do think that it has a mostly good look. The HUD feels good when you're flying through. And I do like that the other teammates will pop up when they've got that communication. But going back and playing it and kind of looking at it through these lenses of a critique, I did find it kind of annoying that I constantly had to take my eyes off of what was going on the screen, because there's a lot going on when you're flying through these missions to try and see what Peppy or Falco was saying to me. And even though it's only a small amount of text, it's at the bottom of the screen. You know, it draws your eyes. Sometimes the lighting wasn't good, so it made it even hard to read it at times. Nothing that was super drastic, because nothing they say really impacts you too much as far as the game goes. But that kind of was just a little bit of an annoying thing for me. I also felt like that there were some moments in the levels where there were some visual issues. For the most part, the assets were good, and especially at that time being a first run game at 3D. I mean, it's really hard to knock for what it was at that time. But I did see, you know, there are moments where enemies or assets kind of looked more 2D. And, you know, when you get into some of the later levels where there's a lot more going on, I thought it really kind of took it back. Like when you get to Venom and there's all sorts of shapes, you know, towers, all these things kind of coming in on you, it just seemed like it lost a little bit of its fidelity versus when you're on Quineria at the beginning and it's really bright. And, you know, all of those arches that we talked about are, like, clear. You can see all the enemies, the robots, whatever it may be. I just thought that some of that came down a peg as you moved into space and some of the busier levels towards the back end. So I totally agree with music and the sound effects. I thought they're on point, and they really helped bring things to life, even though a lot of what you're seeing is very simple. But I did stick with a half star here just because of some of those little details that I noticed that just weren't quite there.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And that's totally fair. Like, really driving home your point where you're in the space level, and I'm thinking when you're going through the asteroid belt specifically, and there's like a million asteroids coming through you, it is hard to navigate, read what the text is saying, and keep shooting. Like, you find yourself just shooting.
Yes.
And not because of a gameplay standpoint, but more because that's the safest bet graphically. You're like, can I destroy that? Can I not destroy that? I don't know.
Right.
So I'm just going to shoot just in case. And you're right. In the coloring of some of the later levels, I think of definitely in Venom, there's a moment where the background kind of goes red and like the game loses a lot of its shape and a lot of its depth when the background goes red. You're right. On Cornelia, when the background is blue and everything's bright and there's a clear surface level and a skyline, it makes it very easy to navigate up, down, left, and right. But as you get into the space levels and like the color, when the colors get distorted, it does throw it off. So, you know, can't argue with the half point being deducted there.
Yeah, and one thing, and it's another perfect segue into gameplay here, but one thing I had noted, especially after seeing the high score documentary, was that there's a clear distinction between the planet levels and the space levels. And there's a reason why. And they showed it in that documentary that the game, up until the point where they figured out 3D tech and made some of those other decisions, the game was essentially built like the space levels are.
Yeah.
And so you almost have like two games in one, with the space levels being first person, where all the 3D is pretty much just what's out in front of you. And I think you can tell where it might have been an earlier part of the build, because, you know, comparing them directly to Quineria or Venom, you know, the planets, it where you're third person and they're much more 3D, they're much more dynamic. I think that it shows that, you know, they had these early levels and they still wanted to bring them to us. Yeah. But then they developed these other levels down the line a little bit once they had 3D figured out.
Oh, yeah. And that's absolutely fair. And I think we'll get into it as we just go ahead and segue into gameplay here. One of the big things I did notice is that those levels are easier to play from the first person view. And so you find yourself actually shifting from the third person view of the R-Wing to the first person because it makes the level easier from a gameplay perspective.
Right. Yeah, I totally agree. Even though you still have some moments where maybe like you would run into something, you think you could clear it, but you know, because you couldn't see the R-Wing, maybe you'd still hit that asteroid with your wing or something along those lines. I did feel that the space levels were definitely much easier. But it does, with the gameplay, it does provide a nice balance where you get, you know, the variety of perspectives, which is something we also didn't see ever back then. I mean, you pretty much got one perspective for whatever the game was, and that's what you were stuck with. So even just going from first to third person was kind of a leap as far as what gamers were experiencing at the time. And then even in some of those space levels, especially towards the end, you start out in first person and then they shift you back to third person as you go into different parts of the level. So there was a lot going on there as far as gameplay goes. I mean, it is an intense action shooter from the get-go. You know, there are very few down moments in this game, whether it's fighting off enemies, saving your co-pilots from people that are pursuing them, collecting power-ups, navigating the levels and trying to avoid all of the different, you know, environmentals that could attack you. There's a lot that you have to deal with from moment one.
Oh, 100%. Like, it's just full action. Like I said, even on the asteroid belt levels, you're just pounding the blaster button just because there's a lot going on. You don't know what's an enemy. You don't know what's not an enemy, but you need to destroy all of it to clear your path. So, and there is a lot, and it is very, very difficult, but I think it's smooth. Like, and that's kind of like the biggest shock to me. Here we are, you know, 27 years later, and the game is still as smooth as it feels like. And honestly, I put it up there as one of the best airplane flight fighters I've ever played, even comparison to your Ace Combats. And I know you recently played Star Wars Squadrons. And I think we had a moment there with Star Wars Squadrons as far as gameplay and all of that.
Yeah, I kind of called it out in sauciness, but I'll go ahead and throw it in here. But I said to you right after we started playing Star Fox 4 for this chapter that I was having more fun with it than I did with Squadrons.
Yeah.
You know, and think about that. 1993 versus 2020.
Yeah.
Super Nintendo versus, you know, Xbox One X, top tier graphics. And it's not that Squadrons was a horrible game per se, but I mentioned it in one of the chapters we had a while back. It just was kind of bland and boring and very repetitive, you know?
Yeah.
Whereas here, you know, from moment one, you are in the action and you are having to navigate and it's not just that, but you have a lot of different enemy types.
Yeah.
You've got different environmental types that are coming at you. And so you are adapting, reacting, changing. And it kept my attention more. Like I know that's so crazy to say. I knew it at the time when I said it, but that was my sentiment was if I'm going to look at playing Star Wars Squadron or Star Fox, I think I'm going to choose Star Fox.
Yeah. There's something to be said for that. I mean, I'm glad that you brought up the enemy variation because that is something that I also highlighted that every level and every enemy is unique in their own way, whether it's like the tall robots or the little like, you know, they look like butterflies that always chase your buddies. Every single, whether it's Cornelia, Venom, the asteroid track, the alternate planets, when you take the difficulty tracks, like difficulty track 2 or 3, every planet was uniquely designed with its own set of enemies.
Right.
The different boss types, like that was also a huge variation. You don't really fight the same type of boss twice until you get to the end and you have to, you know, but that's classic video game. When you get to the final boss, you have to beat, you know, two mini bosses that were also previous bosses. That's just video games.
Right.
But I you know, I applaud Star Fox for that and that a 1993 game, they could have easily cut corners and reskinned some things and used it over, but they didn't. They developed every single bit of it down to every nook and cranny. And I think that needs to be applauded and definitely given a shout out.
Yeah. And what I think is also kind of interesting from that perspective to think is that The levels are fairly short.
Yeah.
You know, you can beat Star Fox beginning to end in probably 30 to 45 minutes every time, you know, if you can, if you get through it all. And you do have the different difficulty paths. There's like three different difficulty paths with, you know, four or five missions per. But even with them being short, you don't feel like you're missing anything.
No.
Because they are so packed full of action while you're in them. You know, so it's like, and a lot of times in games, especially these days, if we see something that is super, super short like that, you know, really just potentially a couple of minutes per game, you know, that will immediately turn you off or be a problem. You don't feel like you're getting your money's worth. But for whatever reason, it just works with Star Fox because your anxiety just kind of goes through the roof as soon as you start playing a level because there is so much. And really, even though a lot of the enemies and the events that happen in each level are the same, they'll still catch you. They'll still work you, and you'll be like, what happened? And you went down, you crashed, or you try to take a different path on the level and you don't quite work out. So it really kind of picks up its shortcomings and delivers in some other areas to make it so you don't even consider them shortcomings.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. And that's kind of one thing I had written down here is the gameplay is where this game shines the most.
Absolutely.
From the barrel rolls to the blasters, the double blasters, the bombs, the boosts, the gameplay is what's going to keep you coming back to this over and over and over. And honestly, to the point where, like you said, you're not even going to notice that it's only a 30-minute game because all you want to do is just replay it so quickly.
Well, one thing, too, from that perspective that kind of gave me a new thought on this game this time around, you know, who knows how many times I've played Star Fox in my life. And it's not like it's a game where, like, we constantly come back to it, but every so many years, get a bug up the ass,
yeah,
pick it up, throw it in, or, like, when the SNES Classic came out, you know, the little mini console, it was on there. So, yeah, let's play some more Star Fox for the first time in a while. But I really started to look at this game a little different, and maybe it was having that background knowledge from High Score, but thinking about where, you know, shooting games, plane shooters were at the time where the vast majority of them were vertical scrollers.
Yeah.
Looking at what they did here with the 3D version, as I was playing it, it really dawned on me that it's still exactly like a vertical scroller. You know, you are essentially going from one point straight into another direction, just instead of top to bottom, you're going, you know, straight out onto the horizon.
Yeah.
And, you know, you've got power-ups that you're trying to grab to change your blasters, different enemy types coming at you from behind, from in front, from the sides. It's got all of those same mechanics as those classic, you know, like 1942 and Raiden and some of those kinds of games that were really iconic. I know a lot of people have played a ton of them. And I think maybe that's one reason, too, why I always like this game so much is because I love those vertical scrolling plane games. And this kind of really fit more into that category than I think I ever let on or realized.
Yeah. And as you say that, I'm thinking, yeah, the ability to like boost forward and draw back.
Mm-hmm.
All of those are there in games like 1942. So it really is like just gameplay. And I think I know where our number is going here, but we didn't slap a number on it yet. But what did you number this as?
Well, before we get to our rating, there's a different number I want to talk about because one thing we have not mentioned yet here is that, because just like some of those more arcadey style games, you know, would keep your high score, Star Fox also keeps a high score. So as you go through, the more you destroy in the enemies, more power-ups you pick up, all of those types of things, it adds up to a high score, and it tracks it through your playthrough. So both of us beat Star Fox while we were doing this. I know we both had high scores here, so I want to see right here, we haven't talked about it, who got the higher score in their playthrough. So I took down both the highest score and the average score percentage that it was giving us for each, or giving me for each level. But what was your high score, Kyle?
I only took just the high score, okay. So I don't have the averages. But my high score was 47,800.
Ooh, that is commendable.
Yeah, you say commendable, so no, it's not beating yours.
Got it.
Got it.
It was close, though. I had 51,600.
Oh, yeah. Nice.
So I thought that was kind of cool. My average score percentage on the levels was 86%. So it tallies and tells you, you know, there's a max score that you can get on every level. And so at the end of the game, it would give you that average of what you were getting. And so I was at 86%.
Nice. Well done. Do we know? I don't know if we know the high score, the all-time high score, because I'm sure everyone out there has done speed runs and everything else.
Yeah, it'd probably be hard to say. I haven't looked it up, but if you just think about maybe like 86% getting 51,000, maybe somewhere in like the 75,000 range would be a perfect score. Okay. That'd be an interesting stat to look up. But either way, I wanted to throw that out there since we were playing through it. Little competition is always good. You know, that's what high scores are all about, right?
I want my initials on the top.
Exactly.
Unfortunately, that didn't happen.
Today, it's CLH. All right, well, how about that other score then? What did you rate it for gameplay?
Like I said, I think I telegraphed it a little bit here. Being the, without a doubt, the best part of this game, it's a 1.
Absolutely. I had it at a 1 as well. Definitely tough to go with anything less on this one. It's a ton of fun to play.
Yeah. I mean, like we said, 27 years later, and it's more fun than a 2020 game. Like, just, that is staying power right there.
Somebody's going to hit me up on social media and be like, I will fight you over that.
And then you'll get a million other people backing you.
All right, well, we got two categories here, and then we will wrap up with our overall final scores. So next up here, we have technical performance. What did you think about how well this game played?
I thought, like I said, it was super smooth from going through the levels, being able to adjust the camera from the first person to the third person, flying through the gates, the camera movements. That maybe is one area where it could be knocked, is like there are some wonky moments with the camera where you actually get hit by something or take damage because the camera got a little away from you, but it's very few and far between. It doesn't happen all that often. And I thought the planet levels versus the space levels versus like the Death Star type moments where you fly through a space station, they all looked great, felt great. You know, it played uniquely. Like I said, each different enemy type needed to be destroyed differently. So it was a different task. And like I said, overall, just very smooth. And for a game that came out in 1993, incredibly innovative. So my technical performance is a 1, because while it did have those clunky moments, I still feel like it handles really well. And is better than a lot of the combat games we see now, a lot of the air combat games we see now. So, you know, it held up and it got the full score for me.
Yeah, I think it was pretty close. I totally agree on how tight and smooth the flight controls feel, despite really having that limited flight path and limited, you know, capabilities at the time. For me, though, I thought that there was kind of two factors as to what I rated it on. And the first one was that, you know, I thought that it was really good to see that it is super consistent. And I mean, that's a hallmark of cartridge games. But just one thing, you know, playing it on, we played it on an emulator, played it on the Switch, played it on cartridge. And, you know, no matter how many run-throughs that I had, it fires up, it plays consistent.
Yeah.
There's very little issues there. And so that's always good from a technical performance standpoint. But where I did end up dropping it down to a half star overall was because, you know, I mentioned it earlier, I did think that there was a few moments where, you know, the graphics came down a little bit, almost got a little pixelated at times, just depending on exactly what was happening. And for me, it was more about the blasters. So I felt like at times I had some lag in the blasters, and it could have been the game, or maybe it was just because I have a notoriously quick thumb when it comes to tapping buttons. You know that. Can't take the taker in Rumble, you know?
Royal Rumble.
But I felt like, you know, it wasn't keeping up with my input on the blasters. So, like, I would get a pew-pew-pew and then a stop and then a pew-pew and a stop, pew-pew-pew. You know what I mean? Like, it just wasn't quite consistent, even though it felt like you should be able to just keep a unlimited stream the way that it was set up.
Yeah.
So that was one thing. But the other thing was that there was just a few times where I felt like it was really tough to hit what I was shooting.
Okay.
And you mentioned the Death Star moment, you know, the Armada level there, when you go into that final spaceship, Death Star type thing, and you're in the reactor, and it's got the three enemies with the lightning buzz that can hurt you,
yeah.
And you're in a tight little room spinning circles.
And it's spinning circles while you're spinning circles.
Right.
Yeah.
And
okay.
It was super hard to hit those things. I mean, I felt like, you know, 5-7 minutes, I don't even know, 10 minutes, and I'm sitting there just blasting.
Yeah.
And no matter how well I thought I had it lined up, I just wasn't hitting them. And
yeah.
I just had to keep going at it until they finally got destroyed. And I died a few times trying to do that because, you know, you can take a lot of damage. There's other enemies coming in that start attacking you. And then as soon as you finally do blow up all three of them, then it starts shooting missiles at you from the center. So, you know, that was just one of the tougher parts that I thought that, whether it was by design or just, you know, an issue with the development, you know, with the blasters, you know, it just kind of annoyed me at times. So really a minor knock, but I was looking at it. It was something that kind of kept coming up to me. And for that, I dropped it to a half star.
And that's totally fair. You know, I had this huge grin on my face as Chris was explaining that because I'm realizing I had the exact same problem. And then especially when you get down to one last little laser beam and you just can't hit it and you're just going round and round and round and you're missing it on every single pass. And then, you know, every like third pass, they drop more little, you know, spawned enemies on you and you just knock them out real quick so you can get back to the laser, but you still can't hit it. So I'll ask you, in that moment where it's spinning you around the room, do you stay on one flight path, or when the room turns, do you turn so you can fly into it instead of flying backwards?
I kept staying on one flight path as far as direction, and then I was moving left and right trying to take different angles on the enemies.
Okay. So one thing I noticed in that specific boss battle is, so the room is spinning counterclockwise. And you're flying straight in, the lines are coming at you.
Yep.
And then it'll stop and reverse course and start spinning clockwise.
Right.
So what, and then next thing you know, you're kind of like they're coming in from behind you. What I've noticed is that you can actually pivot the R-Wing to the right and continue to have it flying at you, which makes it a lot easier. I say that, I picked up on it at the end of the boss battle, and then that's how I beat the boss battle. But, you know, going back and then playing that level again, I beat that boss much faster the second playthrough because I was like, oh, okay, now I remember how to beat this guy the best way. Of course, it's still a technical failure on the game's part, but I have now found a way to get around that and make
okay.
it not so bad. You know, I'm not saying give the point back, but
no.
it was one thing that I noticed, and that's just maybe old gaming, like retro gaming is...
Yeah.
This is a design flaw, and there's no updates. You're not going to get a push. You're not going to get version 1.6. This is what you're getting, so you learn to deal with those flaws.
Well, maybe not even a flaw. Now that you bring up, I think it's kind of a good pro tip, right? I didn't know that you could turn around in that. As many times as I've played it, I have always gone in and gone after it from the direction that it starts you off, so... But in the same vein, so maybe not a design flaw, but with games like these, a lot of that stuff was deliberate in old games where they wanted you to figure out this one specific way to do it, which would be, you know, so much easier. Like, there's tons of games where you can do it the hard way or you can figure out the easy way, and it was kind of built like that. It's just more of a mystery for you to figure out or... you know, learn from a friend. So
yeah,
that's a cool tip that I'll have to go back and try in the future because I did not know that, but still going to leave it at the half star for now.
Which is totally fair because it does have the other shortcomings that we talked about.
Sure. Well, Kyle, that does bring us here to our last category, the Geek Ketchup Special of sauciness. And this is really around, you know, just kind of that it factor, right? You know, does it have staying power? Does it push your buttons? And so we always like to throw this in there for every game because, you know, that's kind of a unique thing for any individual gamer. No matter how good or bad the game is, sometimes it just does it for you. And so we look at that as the sauciness factor. Where were you at with this one?
For sauciness, gonna shift it and call it foxiness. one. And I mean, this game gets the full sauciness factor for sure. Fox McCloud is a legend. And Star Fox as a airplane space shooter still to this day scratches that itch when you want to go play a dogfighting game that you can go to a 1993 Super Nintendo game and feel completely satisfied. So I think that paired with obviously just the legendary status of Fox means it's all over. It's super saucy.
Yeah, I totally agree. Could use a little bit more story, but where you have Fox and the R-Wing and the action, you know, it really just pushes all the other buttons. I had it here, as I said earlier, that, you know, this is where I was going to originally talk about Squadron, so I'm not going to go back into that, but I think that that really explains and kind of sums up how I look at this, you know, look at this game, and helps show what you're saying as far as a 1993 game really standing the test of the time. This is one of the true classics to me.
Yeah.
You know, it's not as highly sought after and it's easily overlooked by the majority of gamers, but I think that really Star Fox is one of the true classics. And I honestly, I fall in love with it. I fall back in love with it every time I play it. And I think that's kind of the best way to sum it up for me is, you know, I may go a couple years without looking at you, but when I come back and we hang out again, you know, you're going to remind me why you were always one of my best friends. You know what I mean?
It's true. It's true. That is an excellent way to look at this game because you're right. You know, it's very rarely when people talk about Nintendo classics, you hear, oh, you know, Mario, Zelda, Donkey Kong. Nobody's ever throwing in Star Fox. But the fact of the matter is it is in that conversation and deserves to be in that conversation.
For sure. So I had it at the full one star here for sauciness, and I don't think anybody should argue that. I love this game.
and I don't, you know, I don't think very many people will, honestly. No. I think the majority of Nintendo fans out there should recognize. Maybe they're not adding it in that conversation, like I said, but, you know, if they were to sit down and have a long-form conversation about the best Super Nintendo games of all time, or the most iconic Super Nintendo games of all time, it's going to be on there. I mean, it was added to the SNES Classic playlist. It was added to the Switch Online SNES playlist for that reason.
Sure. Definitely can't argue that. All right, well, let's wrap it up here, Kyle. What did you have as your total rating out of 5 stars for Star Fox?
So in the end, it got 4 stars, 1 for gameplay, 1 for sound, 1 for technical performance, 1 for sauciness, and then the lone rating that didn't get anything was story for a total of 4.
Yeah, I'm surprised you still ended up coming out a little bit above me. I was at 3.5 stars out of 5, simply because I did give it 3 of the half stars as we went through. Probably seems a little odd because I just confessed my love for this IP. But being objective, looking at some of the shortcomings, that's where I fell, and I still think it's a quality game.
Yeah, oh, absolutely, and that's why sauciness is there.
Exactly. Brings it in.
So Star Fox helped revolutionize the video gaming industry, playing a major role ushering in an era of 3D movement previously never seen, while also giving Nintendo yet another iconic mascot and series for them to build off of. Hit us up on social with your thoughts on this SNES classic, as well as the entire Star Fox series.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this chapter, be sure to hit the subscribe button to get new chapters of Geek Ketchup every 2 weeks on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, CastBox, or wherever you listen to your podcast. Be sure to follow the show on social media, and you can find us on Facebook and YouTube at Geek Ketchup Podcast, or on Twitter and Instagram at Geek Ketchup Pod. Links to all these accounts are in the show notes below and on our website, geekketchuppodcast.com. Stay saucy, you nerds.